It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll explore the intersection of poetry, Alzheimer's, and storytelling.
First, a crowd that police estimated in the thousands gathered in front of the Capitol building in Madison this morning to protest two bills that organizers say unfairly target immigrants.
Protesters call today a day without Latinos and immigrants. People opposing those bills have been encouraged not to go to work. Businesses, some of them, have closed for the day in hopes of demonstrating the impact of Latino and immigrant workers.
One bill, SB 533, has passed the House and Senate and awaits approval from Scott Walker. It would restrict counties from issuing local ID cards to undocumented immigrants and others.
The other bill, AB 450, bans what are called sanctuary cities by some, cities where public employees, including police, are not allowed to ask people about their immigration status. That bill's passed the Assembly. It's on its way to the Senate. Here to tell us more about the protest today is Christine Newman-Ortiz, Executive Director of Voces de la Frontera, an immigrant rights and low-wage worker center based in Milwaukee. Christine, thanks for joining us today.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, before we get into those bills themselves, talk a little bit about the protest and the message that you were sending with today's rally.
Well, it was just, we know this is a historic day. It's a historic day for Wisconsin, but it's a historic day for the country. A day without Latinos and immigrants, it is a general strike in the same way that it was called in 2006 to protest the U.S. Congressman Sensenbrenner's national pending bill. And we've had the exact same response, call to action, that same level of commitment. It wasn't just the same level of mass march as of Act 10 in the last 5 years, but it also was a work stoppage, and hundreds of students walked out from all over the state. So it was a very powerful message that people are very, very serious about not being targeted by these discriminatory anti-immigrant bills and having their families threatened. They're not going to stand by idly, and they know that they contribute positively, necessarily, to the state's economy, and they were using that power to send a very strong message.
Well, let's look at the pieces of legislation in particular. First, the one that says, hey, local governments, you can't ban employees, police, and others from asking about immigration status. What do you see as the impact of that?
Well, people, two very real things. I mean, one, that it's basically a green light saying, to inquire about immigration status. And so we know when that happens that, anyone who looks Latino, who has an accent, that really opens the door to law enforcement or others profiling others and harassment. And then on the other hand, for people who are undocumented, it means that good policies, good local law enforcement policies that say that people should not be afraid to come forward and report crimes or if they've been a victim or a witness to a crime, to have that confidence to talk to law enforcement, that those would similarly be challenged. And even though they've tried to make some amendments to it, in effect, it does turn that police mandates them to really play a stronger immigration enforcement role in handing people over to immigration. So we know people are caught up in situations where they have no criminal record or simply now will be afraid to approach police.
Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss says the protests are based on what he says are fear and misinformation about the legislation. With that one in particular, he says, and supporters of the legislation say, this is just when someone is arrested. So if you're being arrested, you've committed a crime, that's when we're asking about status. And if you're here and undocumented and committing crimes, then it's reasonable to ask about your immigration status. And if you're committing crimes, you risk being deported.
I think they're just playing mind games with themselves, obviously, because you have tens of thousands of people that just went on strike with their families from all over the state to come here and risk their jobs. That does not match the reality on the ground. We know that, frankly, we already have a system in place that if you've committed a serious crime, where that relationship already exists in terms of, the county jail and being, transferred over to immigration. So that system exists. The reality is that there are way too many issues with people who are being wrongfully deported, or as well as, you know, really challenging, really, you know, we have a lot of cases where people, one in a school where a local law enforcement official, there was a scuffle between two kids. He took one of them, interrogated him about his immigration status, wrote on the ticket, you know, without a principal, wrote on the ticket illegal, and handed, you know, and handed it in. In another case, someone with no criminal record ended up being wrongfully held in jail for 2 weeks and ultimately deported. He has a U.S. citizen child and a wife. Those are common experiences. That's the status quo. This is saying, let's turn up the volume. And what is it at the end of the day saying? It's saying Latinos and immigrants are not welcomed. It's painting, portraying them as a danger, and that's what people are challenging. You know, you instead of being, you know, we are valuable to this state, and we're not going to let you break up our families. And that's what happens. Families are broken up, and people are defending the lives they've built in Wisconsin, and they're defending their families.
Talking to Christine Newman Ortiz from Voces de la Frontera. She was part of the organizational effort behind today's protest rally at the state capitol, A Day Without Latinos and Immigrants, it's been called. Let's turn to the other piece of legislation you're worried about on local IDs. And the idea here is local governments wanting to issue limited forms of ID to residents who can't get other forms, state IDs, things like that, often for local use. A state proposal would limit cities and ban, I believe, counties from issuing those at all. So why is this an important issue for immigrants in Wisconsin?
Because this is something that ever since in Wisconsin we lost access to driver's licenses and the state ID under this federal requirement, the state legislature really hasn't moved to create a driver card option as has been done in other states. And in the absence of that, there are a lot of challenges. I mean, one of those issues is, you know, driving while brown, which affects everybody. But then also it does lead to issues of like second offense, driving without a license becomes a state crime. Before this recent amendment, that would have been the police taking you, holding you and handing you over to immigration. And those are the kinds of things that the movement as a whole has been really pushing back and challenging on unpaid traffic citation. So those are the very reality is that people are afraid to drive because they do think ultimately there are immigration consequences to that. So an ID does not give you the license to drive. It does not change your immigration status. But issues like simply having the security to have an ID if you're questioned by police, even though you will still get that ticket. But that gives people confidence, as well as, you know, there's been testimonies during the public hearings of mothers and grandfathers who cannot go into the school because they don't have a government valid issued ID and who want to participate in the activities of their kids. End Domestic Abuse, the state's largest network against domestic violence in mixed immigration status families, when often it, if the woman is undocumented and her kids and she is in a dangerous situation, she cannot go into the court to be able to get a restraining order or file divorce papers. And those are very real things that matter. And there are many other things, a recycling center, lots of ways. And so what we see this as taking away the right of local government to address the needs of the community. And it's not just the undocumented, as was mentioned at the beginning of the show, but there are also folks who would benefit from these IDs, transgender folks who would have an ID that aligns with their identity, homeless folks. So there are formerly incarcerated people who, because lack of money or lack of the restricted documents that are required for a state ID, are also in a similar situation. So we think it's a beautiful thing to form these coalitions, and it's welcoming some of the most marginalized people in our community and saying, you're valuable.
As we wrap up, Christine, after today's rally, what's next?
Well, what's next is that we are encouraging people to go to our website to sign the petition so that it'll go to the governor and our elected representatives to take a stand. You don't have to be Latino and immigrant to take a stand with Latinos and immigrants, and we're ever so grateful for all the support that we've seen. And secondly, it's about really organizing at the local level. We're forming chapters in all of the different areas where people came. We want to make sure that people connect with their representatives, with their employers, with folks there to send that message and create a permanent state structure so that we can obviously work with a wider coalition of folks, but to really strengthen the voice of the Latino and immigrant community. And we also have very important elections coming up, and that's an important moment to also flex our political strength.
Christine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Christine Newman-Ortiz from Voces de la Frontera. She talked about this morning's A Day and Afternoons, A Day Without Latinos and Immigrants rally at the state capitol. UW Health is dedicating February 19th and 20th to Alzheimer's awareness in the African-American community. The days are being observed with free memory screenings and talks by a national expert about engaging older African-Americans in clinical research. In our discussions over the years about Alzheimer's, one thing that doesn't often come up is poetry. Our next guest brings the two together. Fabu is a former poet laureate of Madison. Today, she's applying her craft running the Alzheimer's Poetry Project in Wisconsin.
She's also the outreach coordinator for the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center, where she serves underrepresented groups. Fabu, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, I'm very happy to be here.
Well, can you start by telling us about the Alzheimer's Poetry Project? What is it and how does it work?
Well, poet Gary Glasner created a project out of New York called the Alzheimer's Poetry Project, because what we found with elders, if you use words to stimulate their memory, as well as music, but it's wonderful how art can be utilized in igniting memories, in comforting people about things that they may have forgotten, but they don't forget poetry. So I have this beautiful experience of working with, I call them elders, but they're seniors in Madison at a variety of places, and they come from the generation that memorized poems.
And so you memorize poems with them, or do you take them back to poems that they have memorized in their lifetimes?
Well, I do a bit of both. So I come in with classic poems because I work with African Americans. That can often mean Langston Hughes or Maya Angelou. Some can go back as far as Phyllis Wheatley. So we look at those kinds of poems that might be a part of their cultural experience, but we also look at poems by very well-known European poets as well. I come in and I recite the poetry. They repeat the poetry. I ask them what are their favorite poems, and that's when they pull them up out of their memory. And again, these are people who have been suffering with memory loss, and so it's very affirming to them to be able to pull a poem about Edgar Allan Poe or Langston Hughes up out of the recesses of their memory. And then we compose a poem together. So they give me a line, each person gives a line, and then we combine them into a really wonderful creative poem.
Oh, that sounds like an amazing process to go through. So you must really get to know these people when you go through that, because you're not just dealing with words, you're dealing with histories and memories along with these new creations.
You're exactly right. Most elders are so very accomplished, but they don't have a lot of people that take an interest in what they did when they were younger or the things that they're proud of. So I have a very unique opportunity in Madison to work with a population of people whose voices are not always heard. But certainly, I mean, I've talked to people who marched with the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. I've talked to women who were at the forefront of you know, the suffrage movement, you know, women's rights movements. They're very accomplished people. And of course, poetry is a vehicle of creative expression. I'm so delighted that it can be used to help people with their memories.
Now, I know that you're still a practicing poet. You're a poet laureate in Madison. You're creating these new works with these elders that you work with, and you brought one with us. I wonder if you'd tell us a little bit about it and read it to us.
Well, Gary Glasner has these Alzheimer poetry projects all over the United States and also in Germany and Poland as well. And so he asked all of us as facilitators, because of our work with the elders, what kind of creative expression comes out of us? So this is my poem for our beloved elders with memory loss. Some call you seniors, I call you wise elders, living long and learning much. You should be honored, your gray hair a symbol of victory and authority in life. When your memory hides or flees, and every face seems strange, let there be other signs of love. Gentle touch, kind voice, the spirit that welcomes you just as you are. Reassure yourselves that you know how love feels, for this will chase the fear of forgetting away. So Alzheimer's is very real in the African-American community. It has a lot of stigma attached to it, which is why we designate a time during Black History Month. And this is our sixth annual Solomon Carter Fuller event. It's why we do confidential memory screenings. It's why we've brought Dr. Consuelo Wilkins from Tennessee to come and talk to us about the importance of African Americans participating in the research, because I have the honor of working with elders and listening to their poetry and creating poetry with them, hearing their life stories. Because I have that honor, it makes me really sad sometimes when they feel ignored, or the stigma of having memory loss is so debilitating to them. I have actually seen people in my poetry group through various stages of Alzheimer's. So it's a dread disease, and we really need a cure.
We're talking right now with Fabu, former poet laureate of Wisconsin. She also runs the Alzheimer's Poetry Project in Wisconsin, and she's also the outreach coordinator for the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. And that was such a beautiful poem. So much must come out of this, your relationships with the people that you're working with. Do you have a sense that as you work on these poems with them, that they are strengthened going, they're facing something which is almost unfaceable, losing your memory and maybe the knowledge of that alongside of it? Do they get strength from working like this in art and remembering and having you there to say, yes, your memories matter?
Well, of course, I see the joy on their face when they do poetry, and when we see that even within the limitations of dementia, which is a memory loss, that you're still able to create, you're still able to compose. And it's essentially that your value as a human being does not diminish because you're getting older and because you're getting forgetful. And again, we help people through the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center because there's normal aging, but dementia or memory loss is not normal aging. It is a disease. And of course, it should be treated and fought as a disease. So actually, Alzheimer's disease is now the fourth leading cause of death for African Americans. It's the sixth leading cause of death for all Americans. And I do get both sides of this. I get to encourage people to be a part of the research, but I also get to validate them as human beings.
Now, you're working with them as poets, and as you said, you're also recruiting older African Americans to participate in clinical research. What kinds of things are important when you're trying to convince some people that you work with that it is important to get in there for some of these trials for research?
Well, first I'd like to say that we actually do research with people with healthy memory, mild cognitive impairment, or Alzheimer's disease, and it starts at age 45. So everybody is not, you know, an elder as we might currently think of them, and baby boomer generations probably shaking in their seats. But I tell them how important it is, because if you're not a part of the research, then you can't be a part of the medicines that we need to create that will fight the disease or intervene in the disease. So it's critical that African Americans, and not just African Americans, but every people group are studied, because they have to specialize the medicines according to people's particular physiology. And so I don't have a hard time convincing people so much because, unfortunately, they think one in three families in America will have a family member touched by some form of dementia. So it's becoming so widespread that it's really a joyous thing to encourage people, please be a part of this research. Please make a difference, if not in your lifetime, in the future generations.
Fabu, thank you so much for coming in and joining us today.
Oh, I appreciate the opportunity to talk about the Alzheimer's Poetry Project and the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. Thank you so much.
Fabu is a former poet laureate of Madison. She runs the Alzheimer's Poetry Project in Wisconsin, and she's also the outreach coordinator of the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. She joined us there to talk about her work with poetry and people with Alzheimer's leading up to February 19th and 20th. 2 days being set aside to raise awareness about the impact of Alzheimer's on African Americans. And you can find more information about free events from UW Health on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up, our next guest tells us how her experience with breastfeeding, thought to be healthier for babies and cheaper for moms, isn't necessarily as affordable as people might think. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Medical organizations today, like the American Academy of Pediatrics, recommend that mothers should exclusively breastfeed their babies for the first 6 months.
While it might seem it should be cheaper than formula, the cost of accessories to do things like make breastfeeding less painful or at least easier can add up. Some mothers find it ends up costing more than bottle feeding.
Our next guest, Caitlin Bell Barnett, wrote an opinion piece for The Guardian this month called My Mommy Tax, 6 months of Breastfeeding Costs More Than 1 Year of Formula. You can read that piece on our Facebook page right now. She's an author and journalist based in New York. Caitlin, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks very much for having me.
So there have been some public health campaigns out there urging women to breastfeed. And along with that often comes the logic, well, breastfeeding is free. The mother produces milk herself. Formula costs money. And as a mother who's breastfeeding her child, what do you say to that?
Well, that was very much something that made sense to me before I had my daughter, who's now 7 months old. It seemed to me like, as a prospective parent, there were going to be so many costs associated with having a kid, and I was really excited. It seemed like breastfeeding was something that only I could do for her, and at the same time that it would be relatively cheap compared to all the baby gear that we would be buying, and that ended up very much not being the case at all. It's actually been quite expensive.
So if someone listening to this is going to go expensive, how? You're making the milk, so where's all the dollars? Where are they coming from?
Yeah, so I kind of divide these up into two categories. I think the first are things that moms buy in order to make breastfeeding a little bit more comfortable, but mostly to make it just more feasible and more convenient. So these are things like nursing bras or special tops that you can pull down or pull aside to feed your baby easily in public, stuff like nursing pads so you don't leak through your bras and your shirt. And then there are the medical costs associated if your baby has trouble nursing, and my daughter had quite a lot of trouble, and we ended up paying for a lot of specialty pumping parts, a lot of specialty medical services to help her breastfeed more effectively so that I didn't have terrible pain.
You write that the Affordable Care Act has a provision to help mitigate the cost of breastfeeding, including for a breast pump. Does that help the cost that you're talking about here?
It definitely does, and I applaud that provision. I think it's a really great start that it is indeed required under the Affordable Care Act. What's not required, though, is that moms get a choice of pump. So and they don't get a choice as to whether they rent or whether they have to buy. So in my case, I only got one brand of pump, which is, I have to say, not considered to be, when I've talked to various experts in breastfeeding medicine, not considered to be really the best and most comfortable brand. And it's also not a brand that allows you to insert accessories that are especially tailored for your breast and nipple size, which is very important when it comes to comfort and also when it comes to pumping the maximum amount of milk, because pumps actually extract less milk than a baby does.
So you mentioned your daughter having issues with the latch that made it painful, that there was a surgery involved, specialized breast pump equipment involved, nursing bras, things like that. And kind of what you're getting at there is something that we don't often hear, which is that breastfeeding is actually kind of hard. It's not as easy as you might think it is. And that the making it less cumbersome, less painful, costs money.
Yeah, that's right. And again, the Affordable Care Act does have another provision, which I do applaud, which is that insurance companies also need to pay for breastfeeding education and support. So that means that if moms need to go see a lactation consultant, that is covered under the Affordable Care Act. What's not covered, though, is the cost of for the baby. So in my case, I went to go see a doctor who specialized in breastfeeding medicine, and every single visit for me was free, but every single visit she billed a copay to see my daughter. And similarly, when my daughter wasn't gaining enough weight because of her latching problems, we would go see the pediatrician, there was also a copay for that. So those costs can really add up on the medical side, even with the help from the Affordable Care Act.
And even with all that, I think you said your price tag was around $2,000. Was it worth it to you? Are you glad that you decided to do that?
Well, you know, at each point, I really was committed to breastfeeding, and I still am committed. She's 7 months, and I intend to really try and go for a year. I think that there are health benefits for both the mom and the baby. I think those maybe have been a little bit overstated from what I've read. I'm not an expert on the literature about health benefits, but from what I've read about it, it does seem like maybe they're a little bit overstated. But, you know, I think that it's still great to be able to provide her this really healthy food that can only come from me. I enjoy cuddling with her. I enjoy bonding with her. And at the same time, I've also spent quite a lot of money, so I really want to make it worth it, and I figured that I might as well continue. And at each point, each purchase really felt necessary for me in order to continue at all.
So do you think, you know, given some of the public health campaigns that we've seen, and sometimes it's sort of stated as part of the package of logic there, like we said, that this is something that's free. Do you think it would be more transparent for public health organizations to say, you know, yes, there are some costs involved, but it's worth it, more of an it's worth it sort of motto than going with the it's free aspect?
I do think so. That was one thing that really disappointed me, because when I was pregnant, I absolutely bought into this whole it's free part of it, as I said earlier, and I think a lot of moms do. You know, I got a lot of pushback, especially to my piece in The Guardian, where people were saying, you're going to discourage people from breastfeeding. And my point was really not that I'm anti-breastfeeding in any sense, but that I think that we should be honest with women that if it's easy and they don't experience pain, they probably are still going to have some costs for nursing bras and clothes and things like that, especially if they want to breastfeed in public, which is something that I'd like to stress. You know, I think that we're having a big debate in our culture now about the extent to which it's acceptable or people are okay with women breastfeeding in public, and how much of their breasts they should or shouldn't show. And I think that apart from people's different ideas about that, I think women should be allowed to show as much breast as they need to in order to feed their children. But some women still don't feel comfortable with that. And so a lot of these purchases make it a little more discreet and just a little easier without drawing so much attention to yourself.
We're talking with Caitlin Bell Barnett right now, talking about her opinion piece for The Guardian this month called My Mommy Tax, 6 months of Nursing Costs More Than a Year of Formula. That piece is up on the Central Time Facebook page right now. And one criticism I know that you've gotten is that, yeah, there's all this stuff. There are special nursing pillows. There are expensive nursing bras and soft pads to put in the bra. There are lots of things that you can do that cost money, but maybe this is being over-commercialized. Maybe American women are buying too much stuff that maybe they don't really need, because earlier generations did it and they didn't have all this stuff.
Yeah, and I think that that's a fair criticism. I think that probably I did buy some things that I didn't need. But like I said, a lot of this does have to do with the convenience and also just, for example, being able to nurse my daughter outside the home easily or in a climate that's not a warm climate. I didn't want to feel stuck in the house. And I think that when you have especially a newborn who can't hold her head up and can't sit up by herself, it can be awfully difficult to, unless you've actually done it, to maneuver that child into the proper position to latch onto your breast adequately, and try doing that in public with a bunch of people watching. It can make you very nervous. So I think that some additional supplies like pillows or nursing bras or tops that can pull aside can be really helpful for moms, even if they're not strictly necessary. You know, one other point, my mom breastfed me for a year, and she had to stop breastfeeding my sister at 5 months because she had terrible back pain. And she likes to say, you know, heck, maybe if I had one of these $40 nursing pillows, it wouldn't have been quite so bad, and I could have kept going longer.
And I guess another aspect of this is working moms, because if you're a mom staying home with the baby, as you said, the baby is able to get more milk out, more nutrition than a pump can ever do. So you have to, you know, go to some of these other measures, like a fancy pump in some cases, to make breastfeeding work. And do you think it sort of can, in some cases, disadvantage working moms?
Yeah, I think it does. I think the problem is that we have this disconnect in our country between really the major public health organizations and medical groups really wanting to push breastfeeding as a goal, but us not wanting to make changes in our maternity leave policy to make it at least an option for moms to take 6 months, say, of paid maternity leave. Right now, all we mandate is 3 months of unpaid leave, and that actually doesn't apply to a lot of employees anyway. And some women just really have to go back earlier. And sometimes, even though the law mandates that they get pumping time, some people just don't have jobs where they can pump easily. I'm lucky that I work from home and I have a pretty flexible schedule, and I can pump when I want to.
We're talking right now with author and journalist Caitlin Bell Barnett, talking about some of the hidden costs of breastfeeding. Her article about that is up on the Central Time Facebook page right now.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you and your family encountered this? Did you see a higher than expected cost when it came to breastfeeding? Was it worth it? How did you resolve the breastfeeding versus formula decision? And do you run into some of the obstacles that our guest was talking about when it comes to breastfeeding in public? At the workplace, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our conversation with Caitlin Bell Barnett, talking about some of the unforeseen costs of breastfeeding and how it can sometimes cost more than you think.
You can join in with your questions, thoughts, and your experiences at 800-642-1234. How did you make the decision in your family, breastfeeding versus formula? Did you find surprising costs when it came to breastfeeding and obstacles feeding in public, at work? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take our first caller now. We have Desiree with us in Brandon. Hi, Desiree.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I just wanted to chime in and say, you know, it sounds like her experience was pretty unique, that she had a lot of challenges. I'm a nurse, and I work with breastfeeding moms on my OB unit. And the lactation services that are provided by our lactation consultants, like, you can just come in and see them, and there isn't a charge when women have difficulty breastfeeding. And when I breastfed my three boys, I did it with a $30 pump from Walmart, and breast pads were an expense, and nursing bras. But in general, the convenience of it, when I was shopping at Target, all I needed to do was go to the dressing room. If I had a hungry baby, I didn't have to worry about formula being the right temperature or anything like that. So in general, I think it's pretty easy and inexpensive if you don't have a lot of challenges.
And do you see women who have challenges who do need to have a little more intervention to keep breastfeeding like our guest did?
Oh, for sure. There's sometimes, especially in the early first weeks or so, that women have difficulty with latch problems, and they need a little bit of extra help and a little bit of guidance from our lactation specialist, you know, being sure, watching for cues, what's a good latch and things like that. But, for the most part, not a lot.
Okay, Desiree, thank you so much for calling. Desiree says she works with moms who are breastfeeding, and that maybe the costs that you experienced, Caitlin, were unique to you. What have you heard from other mothers who read this?
Well, I've actually heard back from a fair number of moms expressing that they've had problems as well. One diagnosis that's on the rise is something that my daughter was diagnosed with, which is called a tongue tie and a lip tie. And it means that the lip and the tongue are a little bit too tightly connected to the mouth. And as more women are breastfeeding, this is something that's getting more commonly diagnosed. Some people say it's diagnosed a little too frequently, but it can cause real problems with latch that go beyond just the support that a lactation consultant is able to provide. And that was the case for me. So this was not just a matter of me having some trouble in the early days. And I have a number of friends whose children have also had this procedure. So it's pretty common. And, you know, in the UK, it's actually so common and there's such a demand for it that the National Health Service is behind and they have nationalized medicine. People are paying out of pocket for this procedure. So that's a procedure that can cause a whole lot of problems and lasting problems, infections and plugged ducts in the mom and all kinds of stuff that I experienced and can be really painful. It's not so easy to fix without surgery.
Desiree, thank you so much for that call. And I don't know how deeply you dug into the math here, Caitlin, but do you know what the average cost is for breastfeeding a child?
You know, unfortunately, there's a real lack of data on that. You can find lots of estimates, very back of the envelope kind of estimates about what formula costs. Anywhere, the best data I could get was like from $1,200 to about $2,000 for a year. But most of the data is actually about the overall nationwide or global savings that breastfeeding allegedly has in terms of the health benefits. So they say breastfeeding babies have lower rates of different illnesses, and then they calculate the savings. But what they don't do is calculate what the costs or maybe the savings are on an individual family-by-family basis. So I'd really like to see more of that kind of research.
Let's take another caller here. We have Brittany on the line with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Brittany.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, thanks.
I just wanted to mention, you know, there's a lot of talk about, you know, potential medical issues for the babies, you know, tongue ties, lip ties, which I agree are, I would think fairly common. A lot of my friends have had babies that had to have those corrected. But on top of that, medical issues for the moms that are breastfeeding, it was my experience with my daughter. I ended up with mastitis twice in a very short amount of time, both requiring trips to the emergency room, which had a pretty hefty copay. And then, you know, to treat that, you need antibiotics. So that was an out-of-pocket cost for me as well. So in addition to, you know, babies potentially having medical issues that would increase the cost, there's also the mothers that might have those issues as well that would increase the cost.
Brittany, thank you so much for sharing your story. Appreciate that. And what goes through your mind, Caitlin, when you hear Brittany's story?
Yeah, absolutely. So some of those medical problems like mastitis and some other problems like clogged milk ducts, those also, and what I think Brittany's alluding to, is those can also be caused by the same issues with latch. So if the baby's kind of chomping down a lot on the breast or causing a lot of abrasions on the nipple, it creates this environment where there's a plugged milk duct, and if that gets backed up for too long, it can cause an infection called mastitis that can require, as she said, trips to the emergency room. I know somebody who actually had to have surgery because the infection got so far progressed they had to take out a little part of her breast. I myself had thrush or yeast on my nipples caused by the abrasion from my daughter's latch, and that's horrifically painful. It woke me up in the middle of the night with shooting, agonizing pains not as bad as childbirth, but as bad as anything else I've experienced.
We're talking with Caitlin Bell Barnett right now, author and journalist based in New York. We're talking about her opinion piece saying that the costs involved with breastfeeding can be more than you might think. You might have heard that breastfeeding is free. She says that's not necessarily true when you look at things like breast pumps and medications and milk storage bags, all kinds of things. She said they do add up. And we'll take another call here from Marie. Marie joins us now from Trempealeau. Marie, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I missed the first part of the show, but I just wanted to weigh in on the cost that if you look at the research that shows that infants who are breastfed have a much lower incidence of ear infections, upper respiratory infections, which leads to lost time from work to the parents, antibiotics, clinic visits. And I also wanted to weigh in that the Affordable Care Act has now assured that all breastfeeding moms can get an electric breast pump, a rather nice electric breast pump on a one-time basis. So those costs are all being reduced because of the evidence that's overwhelming that breastfeeding is better for babies.
Marie, thanks a lot for that call. And Caitlin, Marie's looking at some of the macro costs there. And she says overall, if you're not looking at maybe the personal items that you're looking at, the big picture there is that you do end up spending less money when you look at health issues.
Well, I think that's possible, though I haven't exactly seen any kind of economic analyses that look at the reduced cost on a family-by-family basis. They're all, like I said, on this kind of nationwide cost savings. Also, I find some of that, I think some of that evidence some people have taken issue with. Courtney Young has a really good new book out about called Lactivism, where she really does a deep dive into the evidence, which she says has been overstated in terms of the health benefits. I still personally believe in the health benefits, but I can say that, you know, just on an anecdotal level, I think having a child in daycare probably very quickly erases some of those upper respiratory and diarrhea and all those benefits that you might get from breastfeeding.
And we have to leave it there. Caitlin, thank you for joining us.
Sure. It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was Caitlin Bell Barnett. Her piece called The Mommy Tax is up on the Central Time Facebook page.
Smartphones are here to stay, apparently, like it or not, but our culture hasn't quite caught up with that reality when it comes to issues like etiquette and where and when to use them.
And when it comes to walking, there's been coverage over the last week of a growing risk to pedestrians who are texting while they're walking instead of watching where they're going. And it turns out emergency room visits hit an all-time high last year with over 2,500 ER visits.
According to CityLab, many local governments are trying to craft laws against inattentive walking. And the Wall Street Journal reports that some big city parking garages are hiring guards just to keep inattentive pedestrians from being run over by cars coming in and out.
Wow.
So we see this. We're on a campus. There are the youth.
There are pedestrians.
And they have their phones. And I often am dodging on the sidewalk to not run smack into somebody nose in their phone.
Well, me too, but I can't judge because I'm the poster child for not walking while texting. You may recall last spring, I missed maybe 3 days of work after twisting my ankle because I was walking and texting.
Uh-oh.
So I don't do it anymore. I'm a cautionary tale.
Yeah, I only, if I'm stopping, waiting for a stoplight, then I'll real quick look and see if there's a text. But yeah, I just know personally I'm not coordinated enough. I mean, I'm barely coordinated enough just to walk and pay attention to my surroundings, much less without the cell phone. Well, stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.